And good morning to you. I'm Ellen Speer, and you're listening to Morning Drive on Pittsfield Community Radio. Thank you for being with us this morning. I am delighted to have a guest with us, a special guest with us this morning, Lori Norton Moffitt, who has been the director CEO at Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, low these many years. She's been at the museum for almost 50 years, so she's got quite a perspective and an arc of time to talk with us about culture and art and museums in the Berkshires. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you, Ellen. Very nice to be here with you.
So, I mean, very broad question first. You've countywide, then we'll get to the museum. How has the county changed and evolved over the time that you've been at the museum? What are the most important things that you've noticed that have evolved in the county that you think are going to be with us for the next 40 years and that are really important?
Well, I've enjoyed the perspective of living from the top of the county to the bottom of Berkshire County over the arc of my life. I grew up in Pittsfield. My family moved to Lenox. I spent my junior year of college at Williamstown at Williams College, and I've spent my career working at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge. So it's always been, in my view, one full county, even though there are many regional differences that arise from the historic roots of each community, whether it was industrial, whether it was the great estates, whether it was paper manufacturing, or the great centers of education that we have here in Berkshire County. So I've enjoyed that unique perspective to understand the regional differences of the community, but also what binds us together. And what I see binding us together very much and has only deepened over the arc of my lifetime in the Berkshires is the great richness and growth of the cultural community. All of the roots of the great cultural organizations were present. When I began my career, the Clark Art Institute was there. Boston Symphony Orchestra has been playing music since the late 1940s. There's a rich, deep theater tradition. Our theaters are over 100 years old, some of them. And there are many great estates and historic homes. But the collaboration together and richness of working together has deepened. And new organizations have come to life in that time. Some have matured, like Hancock Shaker Village or Norman Rockwell Museum. And I think this camaraderie of a rich cultural community set in the beautiful context of our Berkshire Hills, our lakes, the gorgeous nature that we're privileged to be surrounded by, are both a constant but have deepened in appreciation over time.
Yeah. Have you've been there for your professional career. Did you ever consider any other profession?
Early in my professional life, when one is thinking about what one is going to do after college, I had dreams of architecture, landscape architecture. I was interested in diplomacy, interested in the United Nations, interested in ambassadorial life. But I fell into this wonderful opportunity at Norman Rockwell Museum, which in many ways allowed me to pursue all of those interests and dimensions over the arc of my career here, both architecturally and using culture as a diplomatic tool, both around the country, but globally as well.
I was going to say you have used all of those professions that you wanted to use. You've had the rare experience as a director to move an organization from a small center town location to a much grander facility, a little bit out of town, but still proximate. And you certainly did the diplomatic thing. Was it hard to move?
From the old corner house to Linwood? The pressures inside the old corner house, literally from the overcrowding, were so acute that the necessity to move was clearly obvious. there was a lot of concern and some sadness of loss when that move happened, because the experience in the old corner house was so intimate, being in a homey, roomy, room-sized setting with Norman Rockwell's art. There really was nothing like it. And the early passion of the people who saved that building and formed the early Norman Rockwell Museum was so devoted and really prized in Stockbridge. So it was a challenging time, first to find a location where we could relocate to, but then the emotional shift from the town and the small house to really a beautiful campus, an opportunity to save an historic estate which had another historic home on it, and of course build the beautiful Robert A.M. Stern building.
You've had the arc to see what makes an enduring institution. There are a lot of institutions who depend on a person, but you have created something that is of you, but much more than you. What are those elements of institutions that make them enduring institutions that will go on?
Well, I would say the first thing that comes to mind when you ask that, Ellen, is the deep respect for Norman Rockwell himself, and the extraordinary quality of his artwork, the message that he gave to the world over 65 years of painting, and the view that we hold of his work as a national treasure, and therefore an obligation to share it beyond our community, beyond Stockbridge, beyond Berkshire County, beyond Massachusetts. And we have done that and continue to do it. And that has always been inspiring, because his work is beloved by many generations, including new generations who come to know him. My leadership philosophy is really give the authority, the creativity, the power away. Find the very best people you can to do the work that they are specialists in, whether it's our staff or our board, and support them to be successful. But I think that's an enduring quality of both leadership and institutional capacity, because there's tremendous ownership and pride then in the work that each person contributes to the whole, and that is sustaining and inspiring to each new generation of people.
You mentioned Rockwell. The museum has become so much more a museum of illustration, of which Rockwell is part of the pantheon. But you said he was beloved. He was beloved by everybody except the art community itself for a time. Why was that? Why were people so snooty about Rockwell?
Well, that is an astute observation, because it is true. When I began my career now nearly 50 years ago, he was not held in high regard by the fine art world, the world of art critics, the world of curators and museum directors, even galleries. And yet he had a huge, beloved public following. I think this is one of the aspects of illustration art that is important to understand, because illustration art is disseminated broadly by publication. So it is seen by millions. In a sense, it is the people's art, and it's owned by the people. It is a way that everybody can collect their own art collection. They can tear out an image from a magazine or download it online today. But Rockwell, I think, had the unique style both to, one, have never veered off his narrative realism and being a storyteller of people, stories, and subjects. And this became out of fashion and out of sync in the art world, because during the 20th century, art moved into abstract forms, abstract expressionism, and many other kinds of art that needed interpretation by art critics. People were perplexed. What does that mean? What does a Jackson Pollock mean? And of course, art means whatever it wants to mean for each person individually. But the critics they were not needed for Rockwell. And there was a great turning in the art world in the first half of the 20th century away from illustration art, that it was a commercial art form and just lost the respect of the art community.
Might there have been a little jealousy there, because so many millions of people got the Saturday Evening Post plunked into their mailbox every week, and there was Rockwell. Yet a Jackson Pollock, you would have to go to a museum, and a particular museum, and see it and wait for the tour so you understood what you were looking at. Was there a little jealousy there, maybe?
Well, there certainly may have been. What I have observed, and really from the very earliest years of my work with the museum, is artists have always admired Norman Rockwell. I remember artists coming into the museum early in my career saying, you know, I wanted to study Rockwell in art school, but when I told my art teacher that Norman Rockwell was my favorite artist, I was nearly kicked out of school. And it is so refreshing now to be able to say, I admire Norman Rockwell and I have learned so much from him as an artist. And of course, he went on to inspire many, many generations of artists and illustrators who followed after him.
Now, you're going to be very humble about this, I think, but it's true that you made the market for Rockwell, and you really brought him to the attention of the American public in a way that he never was before. What were the levers that you felt? Where did you feel he needed to be accepted in order for Rockwell to have currency and Rockwell for critics, for other artists, for the public to take another look?
I think one of the very special things we observed at the old corner house, what people saw when they came to see it, was the sheer majesty and magnitude of the art, both the scale of it, the individual scale of works. They're very large. They're 4 feet tall, 5 feet wide. People had only seen them in reproduction in a small, maybe 9x12 image on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. And it became clear that when people saw the artwork, they had such tremendous respect for him as a painter, as a quality artist, beyond the emotional tug of the stories and images he was painting. And so it was clear early on to us that we needed to share the collection nationally, that it hadn't been seen. And it's very possible that the art critics and all of the people in the art world who had been trained and maybe taught to be dismissive of him had not seen the original work and its quality. So when we toured our first national traveling exhibition, curated in partnership with the High Museum of Art in Atlanta, and traveled that our collection to seven cities, and people could see the quality, and especially the art critics in each community, minds and hearts changed and opened, and people really began to see what was evident all along to those of us who knew the art and those who knew him, that this was something important and needed to be seen and saved and shared.
Yeah. The museum at its beginning always punched above its weight in terms of traveling exhibitions and the quality of exhibitions that it put together. Is there one particular or one or two exhibitions that really surprised you when they traveled in terms of the public reaction, that audiences were more favorable than you thought, that it got more notoriety than you thought? And there have been so many, so
well,
I know that's...
Well, there were what I would call three generations of major Rockwell exhibitions that the museum has toured. The first one that I mentioned with the High Museum and Pictures for the American People culminated at the Guggenheim Museum in the fall of 2001. And it was shared and brought on view just after 9/11 had happened. There was a transformational change, not only in the world and how New York City was impacted, but the role of healing that the art brought to the city was extraordinary. And the Guggenheim experienced the highest attendance in all of its history for any art exhibition at a time when all international travel had come to a halt for a while. So I think there was a shift in understanding that the sentimentality in Rockwell's works was a kind of hopefulness and optimism to persevere through challenging times, as people had during Rockwell's lifetime, through the Great Depression, through world wars, through the civil rights movement, and once again during a newly difficult, challenging global chapter. So that stands out to me as a very pivotal moment. There began to be such demand by the museum field to exhibit Rockwell from every city in the country that we realized in a short years later, we needed to organize another tour. And that tour we named American Chronicles, with the idea that Rockwell chronicled so much of American history, both during his lifetime, but also earlier history and subjects that have continued to stay very relevant. That exhibition traveled to 14 cities, and we finally had to put a halt to it because the art had to come home and rest. But there was so much demand across the states for people, their communities, to see Rockwell. The other moment that really stands out in my mind was when we organized an exhibition around the Four Freedoms. These were President Franklin Roosevelt's ideals that every citizen, every human in the world should enjoy four basic freedoms. And these included freedom of speech, freedom to worship, freedom from fear, and freedom from want. And these ideals were what America went to war, joined the war effort that was raging across the globe to defend. And the museum had an opportunity to bring these paintings to Normandy, to the city of Caen, for the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings, which was the turning point of World War II. The immense gratitude to America, to the ideals in these paintings, was still palpable in the broader community in France and in Normandy and in Europe. And this was a moment that was not to be squandered, to realize how ideals can be so powerful to defend freedom and to help save and lift people's lives up.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. I had the incredible opportunity to witness that and the reception in France, as well as the food. It was interesting to me that I always thought of Rockwell as expressing American culture, yet Europeans, and I know in other countries of the world that you've experienced where you've brought Rockwell's art, other cultures have embraced it too, yet it seems so American. Why is it that they have that love?
That's such a great observation. When we titled the Pictures for the American People exhibition, Norman Rockwell's son, Peter, said, "I take issue with you. These are not pictures just for the American people. These are for all people." And as you noted, they have been beloved in Japan. These were seen and enjoyed in Ethiopia, where the American ambassador had brought the paintings and the ideals in order to help bring ideas of freedom to Ethiopia and to inspire Ethiopian artists. And so I think what is so special about Rockwell's work is the stories are about people, and people's fundamental needs are for love and shelter and food and freedom to live lives that are engaging and stimulating and are all about friendship and community wherever one lives in the world. And I think those are qualities people still want, despite wars that are raging and efforts at, you know, power plays that shift governments. When you get down to a people level, people want to be with their families, their friends, and their build their communities.
Yeah, I think that last point, really, everybody, family, community, helping other people, being kind to other people, seems to really be at the heart of it. Talk about some other countries that you've had the opportunity. I know you went to Russia at one point.
Yes, this was a wonderful opportunity with the State Department, and which at an earlier eras believed strongly in cultural diplomacy and using art and sports and people-to-people opportunities to build peace and foster understanding across countries between citizens. And Rockwell himself had gone to Russia and worked for the Office of, the State Department Office of Information, and he had painted portraits of Russian citizens back in the 1960s, and he was on assignment for Look magazine to study the educational system in Russia, and there was an article in Look magazine contrasting it with public education in America. So there was a bit of a reunion sense of walking to the places where he had walked and understanding that, again, people to people, were raised to think about countries in terms of their governments or their eras of history. But when you meet people individually, it's about friendship and it's about exchange. And that was very evident through Rockwell's work in Russia, and as I had mentioned, in Ethiopia as well.
And though Rockwell is the heart of it, the museum has branched out to include the work of many other illustrators, both contemporary and people historic. How do you think about evaluating the work of other artists? Is it in concert with Rockwell? Does that come into the conversation, come into the thought process? Does this work with Rockwell, or is the work on its own merits? How do you do that?
Well, it's a combination of both of those things. I have to credit our board of trustees and the artists we've always included on our board for understanding that Rockwell was not an isolated phenomenon. He arose out of a long and deep and revered tradition of American illustration art, the early illustrated books from the late 19th century, but even centuries earlier in England and France, Daumier, Hogarth, Winslow Homer's illustrations at the time of the Civil War and shortly thereafter, and that Rockwell's story would be stronger in the context of the whole field that he arose from and the artists that he admired and the training and teaching he received as an artist to become an illustrator. And what we also learned and observed was that teaching carried forward with today's illustrators. So when we broadened the mission of the museum around 2010 to place Rockwell in this context, pantheon of American illustration, understanding he was a centerpiece and a uniquely talented and revered artist in his own right, it enriched the museum so much, and it allowed us to work with contemporary artists, which helps you keep your finger on the pulse of the issues of the day. And there are so many hugely talented illustrators working today who are trained in the same traditions. They may have new tools. They're working with digital tablets and computer-generated imagery, and they're having to work at a pace that is faster than ever with the speed that information and news travels at. But again, it's pictures, visual storytelling that helps illuminate the ideas that people care about in their lives.
Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned the technology, because the tools are so different. How has the imagery changed with technology, and how specific is it? As I think of Rockwell as a universal, and is my impression is that digital created is a little more specific, having to do with one specific thing. Is that really true, or is that too narrow?
Well, I think that probably varies by publication. If you look at the New Yorker, which continues to be a devoted and dedicated forum for illustrators, particularly on the cover and also the cartoon spots throughout the magazine, the cover subjects have to do with everything that's going on in the world, and usually something that's going on that week. And so the assignment from the art editor to the artists, they have to work within 24 hours sometimes to come up with an idea, create the whole picture, and turn it in, send it in digitally on time. So they've learned to work quickly compared to Rockwell might have taken 2 months, 3 months to do all of the study stages of a work and paint that huge, luscious, finished canvas. Yeah. And one question that our museum, but many museums are facing, a lot of art is born digital these days. So artists, while they are trained to learn to draw and they need to have that sort of, you know, mind-hand coordination, they are producing their art on a tablet. They draw it, they color it in, they texture it. Everything is done digitally, and the button is pushed, and it is sent right to the design studio and goes to press.
So, do you consider things that are published electronically, not on paper, to be within the purview of the museum? And how is that different?
I would. And the question it begins to raise is, how do you collect? Because we have been building a collection of American illustration art, but it's all physical for the most part. If we have digital imagery, which we do, in order to show it, we generally print it on a high-resolution, beautiful quality print. Sometimes they're shown directly on screens. But many museums are wrestling with how to collect born digital art, because more and more art, and many art forms, not just visual arts, but music, theater, even dance. Jacob's Pillow now has a wonderful digital studio to connect dancers globally in the same space via technology. And so how does one archive and keep that kind of art are questions we're wrestling with today.
And it seems to me that it's a bit more ephemeral. Some of it is created to be here and then gone because what it was created for has moved on. And instead of something that's going to be enduring for the ages, something that's good for the next 24 hours.
That's absolutely true. And if one thinks about social media, even the memes that get created, the, you know, quick artwork that is put together, and I mean, even Snapchat, it's what, 10 seconds or 30 seconds, and it's gone. It is ephemeral. But in some ways, it's not all that different from when Rockwell's art was seen on the cover of a magazine. The magazine might have been passed around for a month in the neighborhood, and many people read it, but eventually it was tossed out. And so there was a loss of these works were meant to be discarded eventually. And what's so exceptional is to have the finished originals, so many of them still extant, whereas we know there were a good number of them that have been lost over time, as happens with many illustrators' artwork.
Have you found that artists that work digitally think of wanting their material preserved in museums, or are they just creating for the moment?
That's a great question, because most illustrators traditionally would have, they would have just expected their work was going to be published and eventually sort of evaporate, maybe not from the memory, but the physical work of it would disappear. So there wasn't an expectation that any museums would be collecting illustration art. So it's really in the arc of our museum's lifetime and the collaboration we've done nationally with a number of other institutions, the Delaware Art Museum, Brandywine, places like the Library of Congress Illustration Cabinet, or libraries like New York Public Library, other major institutions at universities that have collected illustration art and saved this art, that has shifted the mindset of the importance of collecting illustration. So the question of how digital art will be preserved, in some ways you can keep a digital archive much more easily if you continue to migrate it and keep it current, but you lose that tactile sense of pulling the art out of a drawer or off a screen and putting it on the wall.
We're coming up on a break, so this may be a two-part conversation, but you've never shied away from controversy. You have done some exhibitions that were controversial to some people. Illustrating Race is one example, and political cartoons, especially now with a very fraught and polarized environment. How do you try to set the scene for people to understand what could be seen as a flashpoint in a larger context?
I think where we start from and what we want people to take away is the power of a visual image to influence one's thoughts, one's heart, one's mind, and that while ideas are often communicated initially through words, they're underscored by visual images. And we come from this place that the imagery itself is part of the conversation and dialogue at different junctions of history. And so in the case of the imprinted Illustrating Race exhibition, we trace the history of how illustrated imagery was used to reinforce attitudes about race and about freedoms and rights, and how it shifted over time with the arc of history and helped elevate and lift up people's lives. We moved into from the Civil War and Reconstruction era back into the Jim Crow era, that there were bright spots, the Harlem Renaissance, where publishing and magazines like The Crisis were giving a lot of freedom and latitude to all citizens to be able to lift up their lives. So we try to have an educational element, and we stay very factual. So we are working to avoid political statement or polarizing activities, but we want people to learn and to be visually literate, that what they're looking at has a purpose behind why it was created.
Hold that thought. We are going to finish that conversation and go on to some other things in just a moment. We hope you'll stay with us at Morning Drive.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Oh, yes! 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
Do you have a favorite show on WTBR FM? Did you miss the last episode? We've got good news for you. Most of our shows are now available on podcast. You can subscribe to your favorite and have the latest episode downloaded to your device automatically on Apple, Google, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or Overcast. Go to WTBRFM.com/podcasting and find out more today. WTBR FM, for the love of radio.
Let's take a moment to talk about your wellness. Financial wellness, that is. Plan your meals out in advance and shop for the week. This will deter you from spending more than you planned.
Pay yourself first. Think of your savings like a bill you pay monthly. This way you can be ready when life happens.
This money hack brought to you by your neighbors at Greylock Federal Credit Union. All financial education and coaching resources are free and open to the public. Greylock Federal Credit Union, insured by NCUA.
All aboard!
Do you like hard rock and heavy metal music?
Yeah!
Well, then join me here Friday nights from 8 to 10 for Wounded Radio. Every Friday night, I play 2 hours of the best music on the planet, from AC/DC to ZZ Top and everything in between.
This is going to be cool.
Want to hear a song on Wounded Radio? Request it on the Wounded Radio Facebook page. And join me here Friday nights at 8 for Wounded Radio.
Yeah!
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sundrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Ellen Speer. You're listening to Morning Drive on WTBR-FM. And I'm delighted to have with me my guest, Lori Norton Moffitt, the director, CEO of the Norman Rockwell Museum, who I think it's fair to say stunned the cultural world recently by announcing that over the next year or so you're going to be moving toward your retirement. You have been a mainstay of the cultural community here for so many years. We talked a little bit before about how the cultural environment was when you began. How would you describe the cultural environment in the Berkshires now?
I think it's very, at least evident to all of us running cultural institutions, that this is a major economic driver industry now. And in my early years with the museum, I think people felt more focused on their own institution, but there's a recognition that collaboration and working together helps both support all of the organizations as well as the infrastructure that is needed in the community in order to serve all of the visitors that are attracted by the cultural offerings.
It's a lesson, in a sense, that goes around in through generations, because you and I had a hand in trying to focus people on the economic development possibilities of culture. And why do you think that dissipated and needs to recombine now?
I think movements need leaders. And as you and I recall from our pulling together the creative economy of the Berkshires, which included the creative workers of the for-profit businesses as well, it wasn't focused solely on the not-for-profit sector, it included artists and solo proprietors as well as major corporations. And even in earlier years than that, there were periods where collaborating with one's cultural colleagues really helps support. You learn so much from each other. An issue that one institution is facing might be being faced by another, and you can collaborate and also partner on programs and ideas. So the latest iteration, the Berkshire Arts Cultural Alliance, which right now has recently formed amongst the larger cultural entities across the county, is to help raise awareness that we are all dependent on the infrastructure issues such as transportation and affordable housing. The same issues that affect every citizen in our community are essential for being able to bring the musicians, the actors, the dancers, the artistic producers in this county, as well as all of the visitors, and also to support our workers, because our workforce are in many cases, like so many families in this community, are living in a community that really has a wide disparity of wealth. This community economy is supported in large part by people with secondary or ancillary homes here in the Berkshires and may live elsewhere. These are also people who are supporting organizations philanthropically and bringing intellectual brain trust to our boards and our staff. So we are mindful that these are issues that lift up the whole community and are vital across not just the cultural organizations, but for every business and family in this county.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, because I think in times of scarcity, people tend to look inward and at the walls of their own organization to say, what do we need to survive? But I think it sounds like what you all are trying to do is that recognition that we all come from a place of abundance. And the more that we see that cultural organizations are part of the fabric of everything, and that no sector is, even the word sector is limiting, that all boats rise. I talked to a musician this morning who talked about making music with other people was not making music. It was about, and teaching music was not about teaching music. It was about teaching a way of life.
That was beautiful.
A really interesting comment. So with this cultural collaborative and this iteration, what are your hopes and what's your vision for it?
One of the aspects of dialogue is how to work across the state. We've always had wonderful support by our elected officials in Berkshire County, who really represent the farthest region of the state in the state house and recognize the importance of culture and tourism. But in talking recently with Michael Bobbitt from the Massachusetts Cultural Council, one of the areas of focus is understanding that all sectors of the governor's cabinet have a role to play in the support of the cultural industries across the state. So the Secretary of Education, the Department of Housing and Transportation, Economic Development, Rural Lands, these are all aspects of government that at a policy level, if they are encouraged to think about the infrastructure that supports a strong cultural economy, that has a beneficial effect for all citizens in our community. So I think it's really trying to work at a policy level, thinking beyond the boundaries of Berkshire County, certainly beyond the boundaries of our individual cities and towns, to think collaboratively across the whole state. And there's a very positive reception at the state level for this, both in the legislature and in the executive branch.
And it seems like for some reason in Berkshire County, the cultural organizations are more of a part of the fabric of the community than I have seen anywhere else. Certainly in New York, the major institutions are part of the city, but apart from it, why do you think there's that difference here, that the culturals are considered differently than they are in many other cities, if not all?
I think there are layers of answer to that, yeah. Ellen. We know there are barriers to access that aren't always visible, And we work hard as cultural organizations to be inclusive and accessible and welcoming to all citizens of our community. We do this by starting out with education in the schools, and being a small rural community, we can actually impact every student in every school district in this county. I don't know if that's possible in a big city where you're going to reach thousands and thousands of children, but will you touch every child's life? And I think between all of the different arts organizations here, we actually do touch every child's life at some point or multiple points during their education. Those children bring their families, the families begin to feel comfortable coming, take ownership of coming, and we spend considerable focus on being for our community and not only for the visiting transient visitor economy or the second home economy. And so there is, I think, a sense of ownership and cultural pride and ease of access that we work hard to foster and sustain so that the whole community feels a sense of ownership and a sense of participation in the cultural community.
And I've noticed a trend. Rockwell has always done this, but others have begun to, and they're everywhere, that there are free community days, more than I have ever seen before. It used to be that museums were afraid that if you give up admission for the day, the whole thing would collapse. Why do you think everybody's embraced those?
Well, I think it's become very clear if people come once and they have a good time, they will begin to make it a priority in their lives. And when one moves away from buying daily admission tickets and realizes, well, maybe the next step is membership and then I can come free all year long. And in the case of Norman Rockwell Museum, for decades, we have had free admission for children to make things family friendly and a little easier for families to come. Then there is a sense of oneness that we want the community to feel that these organizations are theirs. And admission can be a barrier. There are many other ways of providing free admission. Many of our organizations have library passes, or we provide free access through the SNAP benefits and the EBT cards. And we try very hard to have no barriers for anyone.
Yes. Your grounds have always been part of the museum in a way, and they've always been free, and there's always been art and nature to see, and many others have done that too.
Yes, the grounds are we'll say, a beautifully kept secret. They are open. We have early morning dog walkers. We have cyclists. We have joggers.
You have sculpture.
We have sculpture.
Do you want to talk about what's out now?
Yeah, we're opening our summer sculpture exhibition tomorrow. And I think this is something that many, many organizations now have realized, that the grounds are such a beautiful setting for sculpture and adding a dimension on the grounds. And this exhibition is tied in with our summer exhibition, The Art of Walter Wick, who is best known for his I Spy series of books and Hidden Wonders. And so our sculpture exhibition, Hidden Worlds, has invited sculptors to create a hidden world. And some of these sculptures are tucked away in places that will invite you to explore the campus. It's opening tomorrow afternoon and should be a lot of fun.
And is the studio open as well?
Norman Rockwell's studio is open. And we have refreshed the tours in the studio. We're thinking about reinstallation of a new era for next year. We've been doing some interpretive work that I think it's always nice to freshen it up so people can have a sense of how Norman Rockwell lived and worked in the studio. It's filled with his easels, his paints, his library, his brushes, his furnishings, and you get a sense of how he spent his artistic day.
And you also have other events that on its face, one would say, why are they doing that? Why are they doing a beer tasting? But you've connected illustration art to it in a very artful way.
Well, I want to just reframe that it's the Art of Brewing Festival, because it includes brewing of tea and coffee and non-alcoholic offerings as well, cider and different aspects of fermentation. But the link, as you noted, is illustration art, because we are in an era where beer labels, beer cans, and tea boxes and the use of illustration to differentiate and entice and create an identity or brand around these products is a direct link to how illustration is a very important component of advertising. So we feature the art as well as the delicious beverages that people can taste.
And do you know of instances, and this may be putting you on the spot, and I don't mean to, where someone who became a really famous artist started out by like doing tea boxes or doing Kellogg's cornflake drawings? Or,
well, I think we could look right to Andy Warhol. He was doing advertising art in his early years, trained as an artist, and he actually began to incorporate that notion of brand into his art. If you look at his Brillo boxes and Campbell's soup cans, he moved beyond the idea of art as advertisement to take that notion into art as fine art, wall art, pop art to really delight and perplex. So there are many illustrators who work in both realms. The illustration pays the bills, and they create artwork independently that they show in galleries and offer for sale.
And Rockwell did as well, didn't he?
He did, yes, yes.
Some of it I particularly remember had to do with Art of Brewing, that he did some beer.
There were two beer ads. He did advertisements for coffee, for Maxwell House Coffee. He did advertisements for tea with Lipton Tea and Red Rose Tea in Canada. Actually, it's Red Rose Tea. So there is a tradition right there that links to mission and the collection.
Well, let's go back to you a little bit, because this is going to be a big change for you. COVID was a particularly difficult time for everybody in the museum field. How did you think about what the museum could do during a time where you couldn't touch any people directly?
Well, you were there with me. We recall it was a challenging time for all businesses, really, to sustain themselves safely. I think of grocery stores and healthcare workers who never stopped working or closed their doors to people. But it was a challenge to bring people together safely. We were talking about this with theaters and Berkshire Theater Group being the first theater in the nation to determine how to bring a theater production back safely. And museums face the same thing. Our galleries are very small and intimate and could have only a few people in them at a time. But we very quickly pivoted to producing some digital work and connecting educational offerings for parents who were home with their students and teaching them with their educators, all their education learning going online. And it really built out our national digital connectivity so that now, recently, we launched a virtual field trip where the exponential spread of this offering that introduces people to not only Norman Rockwell, but our museum has been adopted by thousands of teachers across the country, where they're introduced both to the museum and to Rockwell. And there are lesson plans that go along with certain paintings. And hopefully that will entice some people to come sometime. But for those who will never make it to Stockbridge, we're finding ways to connect our work globally.
So it brought some opportunity that perhaps the museum would have been slower to adopt in terms of digital. So we're in another kind of pandemic now, in a way. How are you thinking that not only Norman Rockwell Museum, but the cultural sector needs to adapt to continue to keep its place in the hearts and minds of people?
You said a word earlier in our interview that I've always held close as a philosophy, and that is really thinking from a place and spirit of abundance. There are a lot of shifts going on in where money is being spent, both by the federal government and its impact on taxation, its impact on philanthropy. And when we've gone through earlier eras of recession and times of economic scarcity, I always look to art and culture as a place where there can be an abundance of ideas, and that ideas are free. Ideas and creativity to think about ways to connect and inspire the world is an opportunity to think about how to be part of people's lives when lives may be challenged, and We have to think beyond the barriers of walls and space to, for example, the digital, but maybe just enjoying the grounds and the outdoors and using nature as nourishment and times to reset. So I think as cultural organizations across the country may struggle both financially with different impacts on their revenues, they will always be thinking about the audiences, the mission and people we are here to serve, and find creative ways to rescale or recalibrate to continue to sustain ourselves and be relevant to creating hope and vibrancy for people's lives.
Do you worry? Museums have always been a bastion of truth, and truth is a very loaded word these days. How do you think culturals will need to do what they do to survive as those trusted institutions when so little is trusted?
Well, it is becoming increasingly difficult to know what is true, what is factual. We're all urged and recommended to check multiple sources before we divine the reality of an idea or a fact, because there's a lot of information disseminated from different perspectives. I think what cultural organizations can do is, one, be true to their art forms, to recognize that all of our cultural organizations exist because of artists. And I always look to the artists as places of hope, places where creativity begins. It is the wellspring of new ideas for new generations and new times. And it's artists who helped lead us through earlier challenging times. We were talking earlier about World War II and how Rockwell's art was inspirational in uniting the country at the time. And my hope is that artists can come to the fore and help unite, help retain optimism and hope, and that cultural organizations can be the places where creativity can thrive. And then the path will find its way forward. People will decide what's meaningful and important, and I would just encourage that we're living in a time where it's very important for everyone to identify what is meaningful and important in one's lives, and make sure that they support it, whatever it is. If it's your place of worship or your community center or your favorite cultural organization, at a time where many things will be under threat, we have choices to make of how we invest in and make sure that on the other side of changing times, what we want to have be there is still there.
Our last few minutes, we can talk about a little more personal reflections. It's a hard job to be a director. It's Ben Franklin's cask tapped at both ends, I think. Were there ever times where you thought you were going to leave? You just had it, and new career, new something. I want to go be an architect. I'm out of here.
That's a big question for reflection. I think I spent a number of years, certainly when I was doing the research for the definitive catalog, where it was a very long project, and I'm one who sees things through, so I just can't leave in the middle of something. And of course, that's probably one of the reasons I haven't left, because there's always been something to see through. So this is a shift for me to say this is a moment where my life and the museum's life need to welcome in new leadership. But in my earlier years, I remember spending a number of years thinking, well, I'm doing this while I'm trying to decide what I'm going to do with my life. And then I realized it had become my life, and I loved it. And the challenges were so aligned with the things I was interested in and love. And for me, what has been so resonant with our museum is not only the working with art, but the connection to artists. And I'm very interested in the current events of the world and connecting what we do in meaningful ways to the challenges of the world. And artists are the people thinking about that. And being able to present illustration art and have a touchstone that really has your finger on the pulse of both contemporary moment and earlier historical times to help us understand how we worked through earlier times of change has been sustaining. So there were very few moments where I thought I would move on to look for something else. You know, calls would come in, or there were moments where, you know, something was exceptionally hard and I thought, oh, when I get through this. But then when you get through it, you're like, oh, well, that's done. And then you're on to the next thing. And I think what's hard right now is I do believe we have such important work to do in the world. And in a way, that is a hard moment to be leaving, where I feel and believe the work of our museum is so relevant in the world today. But I know it will continue and sustain. It doesn't need me to do that.
So your successor is identified and you sit down with them. What are the words that you're going to leave them with? You've had many mentors who've given you wonderful wisdom. What's the wisdom that you would like to leave with your successor?
I would say trust themselves and trust the talent and team around them, that we have a wonderful group of board and staff who are passionate about their work, and they will be part of leading the museum forward. Some of my dearest mentors were great listeners, and I'd talk through a problem and they never told me what to do. They left it where I figured out what I needed to do. And I think that's very important for leadership, that there be sounding boards, but that a leader sets their own path and determines what they should do. I would say get proximate with your community and a wide range of people, and understand that Rockwell's art has touched so many people, that he's really been embraced by everyone, and that may be different from some museums where there might not be woven into the community as much as I believe our museum is. So
there's a big legacy beyond the institution. Is there like one thing that you would say to your successor that really think carefully before you touch it?
I would say, as I do share with our staff, go into the galleries and draw inspiration from the art. I wouldn't want to say do this or don't do that or don't touch this, but there are so many stories and answers to what should next be done in the world when one looks at Rockwell's art and understands why it was painted and how it helped people get through a particular time. But I will think about that question so I can be more prepared for it when my successor is actually appointed.
What don't I touch? Well, this has been absolutely delightful. Lori Norton Moffett, who is the director CEO of Norman Rockwell Museum and a mainstay of cultural institutions and cultural thinking, and a very creative one in our community. I want to thank you so much for being with me today, and best of luck as you go into this next chapter. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Ellen Speer, and you're listening to Morning Drive on Pittsfield Community Radio. Have a good day and a good morning.